Alright, and welcome to another programme of Out and About. Now, in our last programme of Out and About, I talk with Donnie Hogan, a Colombian missionary priest, who spent many years working on the missions in the Philippines. In that programme, Donnie divulged the story of how his missionary colleague, Des Hartford, was kidnapped by rebels on the southern Filipino island of Mindanao in 1997, then held captive for 11 days, but eventually was released. Now, unfortunately, just a few years later, in the year 2001, another Colombian missionary was also kidnapped by anti-government rebels on the southern Filipino island of Mindanao, Donnie Hogan.
The next person that was attempted kidnapping, next Colombian, was Rufus Halley, who was my classmate, lived Kilotteran in Butlerstown, County Waterford, about 4 miles from
your own home county.
Hometown, and a wonderful, wonderful guy. And Rufus volunteered. He was working in Manila. So he volunteered to go down to this group working with Muslims. Des was in Mindanao, so he already had the language spoken by the Christians there, which was Cebuano. Rufus had Tagalog, which was spoken in Manila. So he had to go down, learn the Christian, what the Christians spoke, Cebuano, and Maranao, what the Muslims. And like that, again, he did it, inserting himself.
So we're talking about late 1990s now.
This is, yes. He was there for maybe, I'm trying to think now, 20 years with them. Oh, yes. He had gone down in the 80s, and then in 2001, he was there with me when Des was released, of course, waiting for him. But then 2001, 4 years later, an attempt was made on Rufus's life, well, to abduct Rufus. And in the course of this, he was shot in cold blood. He resisted being kidnapped, and they just, you know, his blood was just went right into the ground, seeped into the ground there. Everyone was shocked because he was in this dangerous area, the only foreigner in that area, and he had a young Filipino priest with him. But it was clear during the months preceding this that, you know, there were rumors that he might be kidnapped and his life might be in danger. He was aware of this. Of course, he never shared it with his family. And then with the Colombians, he wanted to remain with the people that he was committed to. And I remember asking, Ruf, is it time to take a break from here, to come up to Manila more often, just the danger? And, well, he said he's been protected because there was a Muslim family, powerful family there, who were close to him, and they were really protecting him. But you can't be protected 24 hours a day.
Because we're talking about 2001, as we all know, yeah, the year of the 9/11 incident. So it was kind of, you know, he was in the Philippines, and what was being played out on the international scene was being played out in Mindanao, so to speak, on the local scene there.
That's right. And as a matter of fact, when Rufus, the word came through here to Ireland, I was working in Ballymun at the time. I had been assigned home. And the word came through to Ireland that Rufus had been shot. And his family had to be contacted in Waterford. The trauma of this for the family, for all of us. And then 5 of the brothers decided, we're going out to his funeral. We have to be there. I travelled out with them. And so we travelled together down to Mindanao. And as we arrived at the church, there was an all-night vigil. Muslims had had their own vigil for him in the parish where he was killed. They had borrowed the body and read the Quran related to the death of service there. But they had their own vigil. And then he was brought to Cagayan de Oro where it was safer for the family. The family couldn't have gone in to his Malabang, his parish. It was too dangerous. So that's where he was buried with the other Colombians. And then we came home after that funeral. We came home. We had a mass in Butlerstown immediately. and terrific support from the people. His mother was there, sister, brothers, the family. It was a wonderful gathering, a celebration of his life and his death. Then we came up to Dalgan Park, and the brother of Rufus, Jerry Halley, his wife is an American. Her father was travelling back to the States that evening. We had a memorial mass here in Dalgan. Just before the mass happened, it was 9/11 was the actual date. All of a sudden, people were in watching television around here, including the family. They were worried about Jerry's father-in-law going back to the States. And this is happening, these airplanes hitting into Twin Towers. And we go into the mass to celebrate and remember Rufus. And 9/11 is the environment, the context. What an experience. And Des Hartford celebrated the mass. Des was alive still at that time. He was here in Ireland recovering. And so he celebrated the mass.
That being the same Des Hartford I mentioned at the beginning of this programme, who was held captive by rebels on the southern Filipino island of Mindanao in 1997, but eventually got free. Tony Hogan.
But what an experience, you know. Des later went back to the Philippines, but then got cancer. Rufus's picture went all over the world on a motorbike in the parish where he was. And it was that particular photograph that this author, Jean Harrington, saw in the newspapers.
You're holding up Jean Harrington. She's a local, she's local, County Mead, County Mead writer. She wrote a book, Murder in the Missions, a true story, excellent book about, first of all, Des Hartford's story, Father Des Hartford, and Rufus Halley. And Donnie, I mean, Jean Harrington sees that photograph that goes viral, but she didn't know him beforehand, did she?
No, but she was a writer. And
she knew a good story.
That's exactly. And then in that story that was carried on all the newspapers here, in that story it did mention how his friend Des Hartford had been kidnapped 4 years ago. And he was alive. So Jean Harrington immediately then telephoned Dalgan Park, trying to find out how she could contact Des Hartford in the Philippines. This is 2001. And the girl on reception said, I'm trying to contact Des Hartford. The girl on reception put her immediately through to Des Hartford. He was at this stage in our nursing home dying of cancer. And she was put through. She asked, is it possible for me to talk to you, to interview you, to talk about what has happened? He said Des was a great man for discerning. So he said, I need to discern and I'll call you back. A week later, he telephoned her. He said, come, but you better come quickly because I don't have much time left and I won't be here when this book is finished. But he agreed to tell her. And as a woman coming in, no connection with church, arriving in, and he actually shared more with her than he did with his fellow Columbans. And therefore, there's such an in-depth study of these two Columbans in her little book. And so he talked. Eventually, he said, you'll have to include Rufus in this book. We're part of the same thing. And that's when initially she was going to see Des and write up about his, because she had never met Rufus. But all of a sudden she said, I need to go to the Philippines. She later went to the Philippines, went to Mindanao. Not only that, unbelievably, got into Marawi City. Now, no foreigners can go into Marawi City at this stage because of the danger of kidnapping.
And 9/11 has already happened and everything. So, I mean, the world is convulsed.
Electric there. But she wants to see what were the conditions like where these guys were working. So she goes in the bishop's car, clothed like a Filipino, and darkened windows, arrives in there, is able to visit the house where Des lived. Not only that, to see the ceiling where a hand grenade had been thrown when, as it turns out, Des was away that night. But there was one of the ladies who works in communication with them on a small radio station. She was there preparing her script. She was killed. This hand grenade thrown onto his house. And that gave her this kind of more and more. She knew this story needed to be told. And also, what she knew also needed to be told was what she was picking up from all these people that she was meeting. She met Muslims. She met Christians. She met a member of that Muslim family that was protecting Rufus, who actually Rufus had made principal of the Catholic school. It was more, I suppose the percentage was, there was more than 50% Muslim in the school, children in the secondary school. It was Our Lady of Lourdes Catholic High School or something. But, anyway, she met all these people and she met the friends of Rufus. She talked, she heard about this dialogue that they were involved in, how Rufus used to work in a Muslim store half the day as in his initial immersion in order to get the language, to build up trust. And the owner, he was the only one the owner trusted with the till. But he did, and they talked about this building up of trust, breaking down all the prejudices that had built up over centuries. And the positive thing, what she got from it was, the Muslims that accepted these two guys to live with them in their homes. Remember, Des was over a year living with this family, and Rufus followed him into the same house. Again, getting language, but the generosity of these people, we talk about Ireland of the welcomes, welcomed these foreigners, despite the fact that they might be held in suspicion by their fellow Muslims. What are you doing here? Why are you receiving these? And not only are they Christians, they're Catholic priests, you know. But they were there not as priests with them. They were there as human beings, and it was on the human level. And that was a foundation for their later work when they went. And Rufus then went to the school. The day he was on the motorbike, I was with him. I was on his pillion. I took the photograph. I was on the pillion going up to visit a Muslim family. I had lived in Negros, never met a Muslim in my life there. And here I am down here in the Muslim area. We were going up to meet a Muslim family, and he brought me up. I had been visiting the parish. And on the way, we met these Muslim kids, and I snapped a picture. Then we went up. The greeting, now I couldn't follow the language. It was Marano. I might have had some inkling if it was Cebuano, but not Marano. But Rufus was welcomed by the parents. He had a project that was visiting all the the families of the senior students in the school, Catholic and Muslim. So it was, Muslims knew that he'd be coming. Well, the welcome they gave us. They brought in fresh fruit, jackfruit and beautiful stuff. Here we are eating and being feasted and Rufus chatting away. He's so at home with them. They're so at home with Rufus. He's so at home with them. And I'm there being welcomed as Rufus's friend and family, as it were. So what an experience, you know. So that was his project then in later. And it was in the middle of that that he was a truck that maybe they had taken over from somewhere, blocked the road from where he was travelling and stopped him and tried to drag him off the thing. And he resisted. Next minute, bang, bang, shot dead. You know, it is traumatic still.
And as Donny Hogan briefly touched on earlier, he himself accompanied the brothers of Rufus Halley to Rufus's funeral in the Philippines.
When the five brothers and myself arrived in Cagayan de Oro for the funeral, which was packed, the church pecked with Muslims and Christians. And the song that was going out over is Time to Say Goodbye, which Rufus had taken back with him on a CD. And he was playing it over and over again. And his young assistant there, Filipino, figured he was preparing to say goodbye. But this was taken up and it was repeatedly, and Muslims and Christians gathering there. And at the Mass, the successor of Dez, he's Bishop Edwin de la Pina, he just commented. He said, for so long we have been trying, you know, to have this dialogue of life with Muslims and Christians here, and we see so little fruit of it. But he said, like the gospel, unless a grain of wheat falls into the ground and dies, it doesn't bear fruit. But if it dies, it bears much fruit. So he said, now, with Rufus's blood seeping into the ground in Malabang, we are now, in his death, seeing the fruit. What he was trying to do all his life, we see accomplished in his death. Because when the cortege was leaving Malabang, going to Cagayan de Oro, Muslims and Christians were standing like guards of honor all along the road. And they were together, weeping, Christians and Muslims, for their friend. And it was like the two communities becoming one because of the death of their friend. It was just, so moving to see it.
He was very much a remarkable man. I mean, it's very obvious from what you're saying, that this guy, exceptional.
One Muslim said later on, he was more than a missionary. He was our brother. I think that says it all.
But also you were just saying, you're just touching it there, that he kind of had a premonition. He knew this was the way things were going. There was a high likelihood, time to go.
Yeah.
Even though he didn't want to go, obviously.
That's right. But even from the point of view of his family, even after his death, they had no idea of the danger. And this Rufus deliberately was keeping it from them. And he was downplaying it from the point of view of Columbans, or those Columbans in charge. He was downplaying it because he did not want to leave the people that he had committed his life to.
And for those of you who have just tuned in, I'm Paul Wright and you're listening to Out and About. Thus far in the programme, I've been talking with Donnie Hogan, a Columban missionary priest, who has just been discussing the tragic murder of his Columban colleague Rufus Halley in the Philippines in 2001. Now, continuing with my interview with Donnie Hogan, here's what he had to say about what it was like leaving Ireland in 1969 to go work as a missionary on the Filipino island of Negros.
Initially, in total culture shock, just walking around Manila, the whole, sights, sounds, smells, traffic, jungle, it was like a jungle. So shell shocked, a culture shock. We moved down to Negros. Now, we were fortunate compared to the guys that had gone ahead of us, and we're in the Philippines since 1929. They didn't have any language school, formal language school. We had small, but we had a couple of teachers, so we had 7 months in language. That's our initial thing. Language and culture, trying to get us ready. And then we headed into parishes. Our term at that time was a 4-year term. So we knew we'd be going home after 4 years for our break. But I must admit, the first term I found so difficult, because we went out, we knew we could say Mass, hear confessions, maybe teach catechism, train maybe catechists. This is what we knew we came out to do. At the end of that 4 years, I think all of us realized, wait a minute, we're coming out at this level here. And whereas the people that we ended up working with or being in the parish, which we didn't have that much contact initially, at the grassroots level, we were in Sugarcane Island. It was the sugar land of the Philippines. And basically, with all this, we came out to do this. I don't say we didn't have all the answers, but we knew what we were going to do. And then we realized, wait a minute, are we meeting the needs of the people at all? All of a sudden you realized the terrible contrast and the poverty all around. You saw no lacking of medicines. You saw little funerals coming in, led by maybe a five-year-old child holding a cross, walking sometimes barefoot, sometimes with these flip-flops, and a little procession of children carrying a little cardboard box and a couple of adults, of children who had died, malnourished, no medicine. And all of a sudden, we're in this area and this is what we're going to do. We're going to come in, say Mass, and because they were all baptized. But the needs of the people, there was poverty, but there was injustice. And our eyes were only being opened to this fact. It was like semi-feudal society, extreme poverty, extreme riches.
The haves and the have-nots, and a gulf between them.
That's right. And basically, at the end of the 4 years, I'd say we just realised, wait a minute, what are we actually doing here? Around that time, about 1971, a year after we came, the Synod of Bishops, this is after Vatican Council, so we were fortunate, the Synod of Bishops comes out with this document on justice in the world, 1971. And in that is this stark comment: action on behalf of justice is an integral part in the preaching of the gospel. All of a sudden, wait a minute, you're not just there preaching. Action on behalf of justice. We went back for a second term after a break at home. Assigned then, I was assigned on my own to a mountain parish, a great challenge, and it was in the middle of martial law, and you had the army, martial law, which was government by the gun, the military, and then you had the other group, the New People's Army, operating in the same place. And the leaders in this New People Army, many of them would have come from the top universities in the Philippines. And eventually some of the local priests joined, because it was everything, the way one priest said it to me, head of the social action in the diocese. He said, look, we've tried everything. We've tried the courts. They got lawyers that the diocese supported and the Columbans also supported for the poor. You could keep them on their land maybe for 5 years before they were pushed off. So he said, we've tried everything, all legal means, and we have raised the hopes of the people, and then they're dashed.
Because the people, you know, didn't own the land, whatever, and they were basically a feudal system. They were at the very bottom, and with the haves at the very top, and they were treated like dirt.
And of course, like what's happening in the Amazon at the moment, these would have been on the land settlers for years. Then, with no papers to say that they were, it's a remote area. Then the powerful would have got titles to this land, of course, on the basis that there was nobody living on it. And come in then to make these, like what they're doing in the Amazon, to make these big ranches for rearing cattle and all this, you know. So in the middle of all this, there was all the questions being asked. Why? Like Dom Helder Camara, when I ask, if I give alms to the poor, I'm a saint, called a saint. If I ask, why are they poor? Called a communist. So at that stage, there was this terrible tension where you had the church trying to stand with the poor. You had the New People's Army, who were working in the same area with the same people, standing at the other side. And of course then, you were being mixed up in the sense, oh, you're communist too. And so there was a lot of tension around that time. And that leads up to eventually when they would touch the lay people, take them up. Some were tortured from the parishes, some killed in the parish nearby, Cabancalan, where Mickey Martin was parish priest, a man from Tyrone. Two lay leaders, one of them, it happened in Holy Week 1980, Alex and Herman. Alex was actually part of the dramatization of the Stations of the Cross, carrying the cross on Good Friday. A few days later, I think it might have been Easter Sunday, it was around that time, he went missing, and their bodies were found in shallow graves. So there was this kind of stuff. But they didn't touch the priests, especially the foreign priests at that time.
Because they knew to be an international uproar.
By the time the 1980s came, when Neil O'Brien was there, they were trying to keep the lid on the situation and were getting desperate.
Now, for our listeners, who is Neil O'Brien? He's a Columban missionary, yeah. Yes. And tell us about this. Yeah, please.
Neil is a Columban missionary, originally from Black Rock in Dublin. And he's like very idealistic guy right through seminary. He was the guy, the model, you know, of everything. He went to the Philippines with Vatican Council. He just a few years before us. That was in the mix. And all of a sudden, he began working with these small Christian communities because we were following what was already happening in South America, where there were these basic Christian communities, the small Christian communities, were gathering together, where lay people were finding out their dignity, meeting together in little chapels, bamboo chapels. Neil and the rest of us tried to follow this. And in the middle of all this, at this stage, even foreign priests would be targets. Because the situation was getting so desperate to keep the lid on, we will risk all the bad publicity abroad. And then Neil is taken, put in jail, etc.
He was put in jail, why?
Because he was standing with the poor, with these small settlers being driven off their land.
And as Donny Hogan just touched on, his Columban missionary colleague Neil O'Brien and eight others, who collectively became known as the Negros Nine, were imprisoned in the year 1984 on trumped-up charges, in an attempt to undermine their work for justice on behalf of peasant labourers. Thankfully, they were all eventually released due to international pressure. Now, to hear more of Donny Hogan's experiences in the Philippines, then make sure to catch our next programme of Out and About. Until then, from myself, Paul Wright, bye for now.